A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a heavy one. The United States is set to sign a bilateral memorandum of understanding with Iran this Friday in Geneva. Israel was not at the table. Israel is not a party to the deal, and the relationship between Trump and Netanyahu has gone from strained to openly hostile. Daniel's question is, if Israel does eventually go it alone against Iran's nuclear program, and he believes it will, what are the signs we should be watching for in the lead-up? What are the tea leaves at this inflection point?
This is one of those moments where the tea leaves aren't subtle. They're more like tea boulders. You've got a deal that Vice President Vance himself described as about a page and a half, and very general. You've got Israel's defense minister saying the IDF will stay in Lebanon indefinitely, directly contradicting the ceasefire framework. And you've got Trump telling Axios, and I'm quoting here, "Why did Bibi have to do a Faisin attack? I was so pissed off. He has no Faisin judgment."
The diplomatic register of our time.
That's the thing. This isn't diplomatic friction anymore. This is a genuine structural break. And the 60-day negotiation window that starts Friday, that's the clock everyone should be watching.
Walk me through the 60-day problem. Because on the surface, Iran freezing enrichment during talks sounds like the one thing in this deal that Israel might actually appreciate.
It sounds that way until you ask, who's verifying the freeze? The MOU mentions a strong inspections regime. Trump's words, but gives zero specifics. No mechanism, no timeline for inspectors to deploy, no baseline of what Iran's current enrichment level actually is. Israel has no verification role and no seat at the table. So from Israel's perspective, this is the JCPOA all over again, except worse, because this time they just fought a 100-day war alongside the United States, and they're still being locked out.
The JCPOA precedent is instructive here. The 2015 deal had verification provisions that supporters called unprecedented. Israel spent the next 3 years exposing Iranian violations, including that archive of nuclear documents the Mossad lifted from Tehran in 2018.
And the key difference now is the sequence. In 2015, you could argue, and many did, that the deal was the best available option absent military action. But this time, the military action already happened. Operation Rising Lion last Friday, 200 fighter jets, over 330 munitions, more than 100 targets in Iran. Israel says it killed IRGC Commander Hossein Salami and Armed Forces Chief of Staff Major General Mohammad Bagheri. Netanyahu said the operation targeted a secret program of nuclear weapons experiments.
The result of all that is a page and a half MOU that defers the nuclear question.
That's what former Mossad intelligence officer Danny Citrinovich called a political and security catastrophe for the state of Israel. And Seema Shine at the Institute for National Security Studies said the issues important to Israel, the nuclear one especially, are left for some future that we don't know.
The phrase, some future that we don't know, is doing a lot of work there. It's diplomatic language for, we got rolled.
And here's the thing about why that stings so much in Jerusalem specifically. Think about what Israel just demonstrated operationally. 200 fighter jets penetrating Iranian airspace, striking over 100 targets, killing the IRGC commander and the armed forces chief of staff. That's not a pinprick raid. That's the largest conventional air operation in the Middle East in decades. And the diplomatic payoff for demonstrating that level of capability is being told to wait outside while Washington and Tehran hammer out a page and a half of generalities.
It's like acing the final exam and then being told your grade won't count toward the course.
That's exactly the dynamic. And it feeds into a deeper Israeli anxiety that isn't just about this deal or this administration. There's a recurring pattern that Israeli strategists talk about privately. Israel provides the military deterrence, absorbs the regional blowback, and then gets sidelined when the diplomatic dividends are distributed. We saw a version of this after the 1991 Gulf War, when Israel absorbed Scud attacks without retaliating and then got pressured into Madrid and Oslo. We saw it after 2015, when Israeli intelligence on Iranian violations was treated as an annoyance rather than actionable. And now we're seeing it after 100 days of joint U-Israeli military operations.
The first tea leaf is probably the obvious one. What happens with Israeli intelligence assessments over the next few weeks? If Israel starts leaking or publishing claims about secret Iranian nuclear sites, hidden enrichment facilities, undeclared centrifuges, that's not just intelligence sharing. That's building the public case for unilateral action.
They've done this before. The 2018 Mossad archive seizure wasn't just an intelligence operation, it was a political operation, designed to show the world what the IAEA was missing. If we start seeing a sequel to that in the next 30 to 40 days, that's a very loud signal.
Let me push on that. The 2018 archive operation worked politically because the JCPOA was already under fire and Trump was looking for reasons to withdraw. The political landscape now is different. Trump just signed this MOU himself. Would leaked Israeli intelligence actually move the needle in a Washington that's already decided the deal is worth doing?
That's a fair question, and I think the answer is, it depends on what the intelligence shows. If Israel produces evidence that Iran is actively cheating during the 60-day freeze, enrichment at undeclared sites, movement of materials, construction on facilities that the MOU is supposed to pause, that puts the administration in a bind. Trump can ignore it, but then he owns the consequences when Iran crosses the threshold, or he can acknowledge it, which blows up his deal. Neither is a good option, and that's exactly the dilemma Israeli intelligence operations are designed to create.
It's less about persuading Trump, and more about making the cost of ignoring the evidence politically unbearable.
It's a pressure campaign, not a persuasion campaign, and pressure campaigns work by raising the domestic political price of the status quo. If Fox News is running segments on Iran's secret nuclear sprint, while Trump is trying to sell the MOU as a victory, that's a problem for the White House.
What's the second signal you'd watch for?
IDF readiness messaging. And I don't mean the routine stuff. Israel's military is always at some level of alert. I mean specific, unusual patterns. Calling up reserve pilots. Canceled leave for specific units. Unusual Air Force activity over the Mediterranean. Satellite imagery analysts noticing the kind of logistics positioning that precedes long-range strike operations.
For the non-satellite analyst listener, what does that logistics positioning actually look like?
It's the stuff that's hard to hide. Tanker aircraft moving to forward bases, munitions bunkers being emptied at rates that exceed training cycles, runway maintenance being deferred because the tempo is too high, medical units being placed on standby. These are all things that commercial satellite imagery can pick up, and there's a whole ecosystem of open-source analysts who track this stuff. When three or four of those indicators start flashing at the same time, it's not a coincidence.
The thing about Israel's strike capability against Iran is that it's not a mystery. Everyone knows the rough contours, the distance, the refueling requirements, the air defense challenges. What changes is the political will to absorb the consequences of acting alone.
That's where the Trump dynamic gets fascinating. Because Trump's incentives and Netanyahu's incentives are now fundamentally misaligned, Trump needs the Strait of Hormuz open. Iran was earning roughly $165 million per day from oil exports before the blockade, and new gas prices are a midterm issue. The MOU reopens the strait toll-free for 60 days and lifts the naval blockade on Iranian ports.
Trump gets the oil flowing, gets a diplomatic win, and kicks the nuclear can down the road.
Netanyahu gets none of that. His defense minister is saying troops stay in Lebanon indefinitely. Hezbollah is still firing missiles and drones. Iran's foreign minister has warned that any continued Israeli presence in Lebanon is a violation of the MOU framework. And domestically, Netanyahu is facing elections in October with 61% of Israelis saying he shouldn't run.
The domestic dimension is worth pausing on. Because it's not just Netanyahu's political survival. It's the broader Israeli consensus. The Israel Democracy Institute poll showing 61% opposition to Netanyahu running again. That's not a fringe number. But the same Israeli public that's frustrated with Netanyahu is also, broadly speaking, deeply skeptical of any deal with Iran.
That's the paradox. Israelis don't want war. Daniel was clear about that in the prompt, and he's right. The Israeli public overwhelmingly doesn't want another war. But they also look at the JCPOA, look at this MOU, look at Iran's track record, and conclude that agreements without verification are worse than useless. They're a trap that lets Iran build capability while the international community declares victory.
There's a fascinating tension there that I think gets flattened in a lot of American coverage. The assumption is that if Israelis oppose Netanyahu, they must also favor the deal. But that's not how Israeli politics maps onto this issue at all.
Not even close. The Israeli left is basically non-existent on security issues at this point. The debate isn't between hawks and doves, it's between hawks who think Netanyahu is competent and hawks who think he's a disaster. Lapid, Gantz, the opposition figures who want to replace him, none of them are running on a platform of trusting Iranian negotiations. They're running on the argument that Netanyahu has mismanaged the relationship with Washington so badly that he's undermined Israel's ability to deal with the Iranian threat effectively.
Netanyahu is squeezed from both sides. He's got a skeptical public that doesn't trust deals with Iran, but also doesn't trust him. He's got coalition partners like Ben-Gavir, who are publicly saying Israel is not subject to the United States. And he's got an American president who went on the record saying, "I call the shots. I call all the shots. He doesn't call the shots."
That Financial Times quote is brutal. It's not diplomatic code. It's not, "We have differences of opinion." It's a direct assertion of dominance. And the Axios quote, "He has no judgment," that's the kind of thing you say about someone you've written off, not someone you're trying to bring back to the table.
It's worth noting, this isn't Trump being Trump in a vacuum. This is Trump saying this about a foreign leader who, 2 years ago, was being described as one of his closest international partners. The speed of the deterioration is part of what makes this so destabilizing. Alliances don't usually go from warm to openly hostile in 18 months without a major precipitating event.
There was a major precipitating event. 100 days of joint military operations is about as major as it gets, and I think what happened is that the war exposed the fundamental mismatch in what each side thought the partnership was for. Saw the operations as a limited campaign to degrade Iranian capabilities and force Tehran to the table. Israel saw them as the opening phase of a decisive confrontation that would end with Iran's nuclear program dismantled and its proxy network broken. When the EU decided it had achieved enough to negotiate, Israel felt it had been promised a knockout and been given a split decision.
Let's talk about the third tea leaf, which is the Hezbollah tripwire. You mentioned it earlier. The MOU includes a Lebanon ceasefire, but Israel isn't withdrawing, and Hezbollah is still shooting. That feels like the most immediate flashpoint.
It's the thing that could unravel the entire framework within days, not weeks. Iran's Foreign Minister Araghchi has explicitly said any Israeli attack on Lebanon or continued presence there would be treated as a violation. Israel's not just continuing its presence. Defense Minister Katz used the word indefinitely. So you have two parties to the MOU, Iran and the EU, and one non-party, Israel, whose military operations directly contradict the deal's terms.
This is where the structure of the MOU being bilateral rather than multilateral really matters. If this were a broader agreement with multiple parties, Israel's violation of the Lebanon terms would be one problem among many. But when it's just the EU and Iran, and the EU can't deliver Israeli compliance, the entire framework looks hollow.
It makes the EU look like it can't control its own ally, which is exactly the argument Iran will use if and when it decides to walk away from the deal. We negotiated in good faith, but the Americans clearly can't deliver their side. It's a ready-made exit ramp for Tehran.
If a Hezbollah rocket kills Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon, Israel retaliates, and the whole MOU framework collapses. Who does Trump blame?
That's the question. The recent pattern suggests he blames Netanyahu. Trump said Israel nearly collapsed the deal by striking Hezbollah in Beirut hours before the MOU was announced. He was, quote, "so pissed off." If the pattern holds, any Israeli action that threatens the deal gets framed in Washington as Netanyahu being reckless, not as Israel defending itself.
There's a psychological dimension here that's worth exploring. Trump's whole approach to deal-making is personal. He wants to be the one who closed the deal, who got the win. When someone interferes with that, especially someone he sees as a subordinate partner, the reaction isn't strategic, it's personal.
That's what makes the Axios quote so revealing. He has no judgment, isn't a policy critique, it's a character judgment. It's Trump saying, I've assessed this person and found him fundamentally unreliable. Once a dealmaker makes that assessment, it's very hard to walk it back. The relationship becomes transactional in the coldest sense. What can you do for me right now? And if the answer is nothing, why am I talking to you?
Which brings us to the fourth signal, and maybe the most important one. What happens with EU intelligence cooperation and weapons supplies? Because Israel can act alone. It has before. But it's much harder without American logistical and intelligence support.
This is the lever Trump has, and the question is whether he'll use it. Has already said it was not involved in Operation Rising Lion and did not share intelligence for it, though Trump was aware in advance. If the EU starts explicitly withholding intelligence about Iranian nuclear sites, or slows weapons deliveries, or signals that Israel is on its own diplomatically at the UN, those are all signs that Washington is trying to constrain Israel rather than coordinate with it.
The flip side of that is, if Israel starts preparing for unilateral action, one of the quiet signals might be a reduction in what they share with Washington. Fewer briefings, less advance notice, more operational security around their own planning.
Historically, that's exactly what happens. The 1981 Osirak strike. Israel didn't tell the EU. The 2007 Syrian reactor strike, minimal heads up. When Israel concludes that American knowledge means American interference, they go dark.
There's a great case study in the 2007 strike that I think is instructive here. The Syrians were building a reactor with North Korean assistance at a site called Al-Kibar. Israel detected it, but they didn't go running to Washington to build a multilateral case. They conducted their own targeting, their own battle damage assessment, and they informed the EU after the fact. The lesson Israel took from that experience was, when the intelligence is solid and the stakes are existential, don't ask for permission.
The post-strike dynamic is just as important. Didn't condemn the strike publicly. Syria, embarrassed, didn't retaliate in a major way. The whole thing faded from headlines within weeks. For Israeli planners, that's the model, not the 2015 JCPOA debate where they spent years trying to influence a diplomatic process and ultimately lost.
The counterexample is also instructive. In 2015, Israel made its case publicly, lobbied Congress, and still couldn't stop the deal. In 2026, they tried the military route first, joint operations with the EU, and still ended up with a deal they hate. So both paths, diplomatic pressure and military action, have now led to the same outcome. That's the strategic frustration that makes unilateralism look like the only option left.
And it's why I think the fading influence, framing that Michael Horowitz used, is so important. It's not that Israel has no influence, it's that the influence has diminishing returns. You can lobby Congress, but if the executive is doing an end run around congressional approval with an executive agreement, that lobbying doesn't matter. You can demonstrate military capability, but if Washington decides the costs of further operations outweigh the benefits, that capability doesn't translate into diplomatic leverage.
The fifth tea leaf. Watch for a sudden drop in the temperature of EU-Israel military coordination. No public statements. Those are already hostile. But the quiet institutional stuff. Joint planning sessions being cancelled. Intelligence sharing drying up. The kind of thing that analysts at think tanks notice before journalists do.
There's one more signal I'd add, and it's the one that worries me most. Watch for Israeli messaging that reframes the nuclear timeline. Right now, the MOU assumes 60 days of talks. But if Israeli intelligence starts saying, publicly or through leaks, that Iran's breakout time is shorter than 60 days, that the freeze is a fiction, that enrichment is continuing at undeclared sites, then the entire diplomatic clock becomes irrelevant. You can't negotiate for 60 days if the bomb arrives in 30.
That's where the JCPOA 2.0 specter really bites. The 2015 deal's defenders always said the alternative to this deal is war. But in 2026, the war already happened, and Israel just spent over 100 days striking Iran. And the result is a deal that defers the nuclear question and leaves Iran's ballistic missile program completely unaddressed.
That's the part that I think hasn't fully landed in the American discourse yet. If wartime conditions, joint EU, Israel military operations, hundreds of sorties, Iranian command structure decapitated, If even that couldn't produce a harder line on Iran's nuclear program, then what conditions would? Israeli hardliners are going to conclude that the answer is conditions where Israel acts without American constraints.
This is the point where the strategic logic starts to feel almost inexorable. If you're sitting in Jerusalem, you've now tried the diplomatic route. It gave you the JCPOA, which Iran violated. You've tried the joint military route. It gave you 100 days of operations followed by a page and a half MOU. You've tried intelligence exposure, the Mossad archive, the 2018 revelations. None of it has stopped the program. What's left?
That's the Begin Doctrine logic in its purest form. And the Begin Doctrine has always been controversial, even within Israel. But it's also been remarkably durable as a strategic principle. The idea is simple. No adversarial state in the Middle East will be permitted to acquire a nuclear weapon, period. Not through negotiations, not through deterrence, not through sanctions. If they get close, you strike. You don't ask permission, you don't wait for consensus, and you accept the consequences.
The Begin Doctrine has a track record. Both strikes were widely condemned at the time. Both are now viewed, even by many former critics, as having prevented nuclear programs that would have fundamentally altered the regional balance.
The Iran case is harder, though, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise. Iraq had one reactor. Syria had one reactor. Iran has multiple facilities, spread across a large country, with significant air defenses, and the ability to retaliate through proxies across the region. The Begin Doctrine was designed for surgical strikes against single points of failure. Iran's program doesn't have a single point of failure.
Let's put this together for a listener who's trying to read the tea leaves over the next few weeks. What's the checklist?
Signal 1. Israeli intelligence goes public with claims about secret or undeclared Iranian nuclear activity. Not background briefings, front page stuff. Signal 2. Unusual IDF readiness indicators, reserve call-ups, Air Force activity patterns, logistics movements that satellite analysts notice. Signal 3. The Hezbollah tripwire. Any significant escalation in Lebanon that Israel treats as Iranian-directed and uses to argue the MOU is already dead.
Signal 4. You starts visibly constraining Israel. Intelligence withholding, weapons delays, diplomatic isolation at the UN. And signal 5. The temperature of U-Israel military coordination drops below what's normal, even for a rough batch. Fewer phone calls. Israel going operationally dark.
The meta signal, the one that ties all of these together, watch whether Netanyahu starts talking about the Iranian nuclear program in present tense rather than future tense. Not Iran is trying to develop, but Iran has crossed the threshold. That shift in language is almost always the last rhetorical step before action.
That tense shift is subtle, but it's something rhetorical analysts have tracked across multiple conflicts. When a government moves from, we cannot allow to, we are witnessing, they've already made the decision. The public messaging is just catching up.
And Netanyahu has been careful about this in the past. He's used the future conditional for years. Iran will have a bomb. Iran is trying to. If that grammar changes, it's not an accident.
The prompt also raised a deeper question that I think is worth sitting with. Daniel said it feels like a genuine point of bifurcation in the bilateral relationship. Not a rough patch, not political theater, a structural break. Is that overreading it? Or is that actually where we are?
I don't think it's overreading. Michael Horowitz, the security analyst, said this episode reveals Israel's fading influence in Washington. That's not a cyclical thing that bounces back with the next election. That's a structural shift in how American policymakers weigh Israeli interests versus other priorities.
The counterargument would be, this is a Trump-specific phenomenon. Trump has a transactional view of alliances. He wanted the Strait open. He wanted a deal. And Netanyahu got in the way. A different president might have a completely different approach.
That's possible. But the underlying dynamics don't depend entirely on Trump. Strategic focus has been shifting toward Asia for years. The domestic politics of Middle East intervention are toxic in both parties. And Iran has demonstrated, by surviving 100 days of U-Israeli military pressure and closing the strait, that it can impose costs that Washington doesn't want to keep paying.
Let me push on the different president counterargument, because I think it deserves more scrutiny. If we imagine a generic post-Trump administration, Republican or Democrat, what actually changes? Still wants to pivot to Asia. Still doesn't want another Middle Eastern war. Still needs the Strait of Hormuz open. Iran still has the same leverage. The structural factors don't shift with the occupant of the Oval Office.
That's the structural realist case, and I find it pretty persuasive. The one thing that could change is the level of personal hostility. A different president might not say he has no judgment to Axios. A different president might manage the relationship more carefully, give Israel more of a heads up, coordinate more closely. But the fundamental divergence of interests, that's not a Trump invention. It's a product of the post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan strategic environment.
Iran's top military command literally declared that the EU and Israel had no option but to accept defeat and surrender. That's propaganda, obviously. But propaganda works best when it contains a kernel of truth. And the kernel here is that Iran absorbed a massive military campaign, lost senior commanders, and still walked away with a deal that leaves its nuclear infrastructure intact and its proxies armed.
Earned roughly $165 million per day before the blockade. The regime survived. That's the outcome Israel is looking at and saying, this is unacceptable.
There's an uncomfortable question embedded in that. If Iran absorbing 100 days of military operations and still getting a deal it can live with is unacceptable to Israel, what exactly is the acceptable outcome? Because it seems like the only thing that would satisfy Israeli security hawks is regime change or total nuclear disarmament, and neither of those was ever on the table.
That's the maximalist critique, and it's not wrong. But I think the Israeli position is more nuanced than that. It's not that they expected regime change. It's that they expected the military campaign to create enough leverage to demand meaningful, verifiable nuclear concessions, not a page and a half MOU that defers everything. The gap between the military achievement and the diplomatic outcome is what's so jarring.
What does acting alone actually look like, operationally? Because there's a difference between a one-off strike, even a large one like Operation Rising Lion, and a sustained campaign to eliminate Iran's nuclear program.
A sustained campaign is extraordinarily difficult without you. The distances are huge. Iran's nuclear facilities are dispersed, hardened, and in some cases buried deep underground. Fordow, for example, is built into a mountain. Israel has bunker buster munitions, but the logistics of a prolonged campaign, multiple waves, battle damage assessment, restrikes. That's a different order of magnitude from a single operation.
Which is why some analysts have argued that Israel's real goal wouldn't be comprehensive destruction, but rather a setback strike. Hit enough key facilities to delay the program by years, signal that the cost of pursuing a bomb is prohibitive, and accept that it's not a permanent solution.
The Begin Doctrine, essentially. And Israel has done this before. Iraq in 1981, Syria in 2007. But Iran's program is much larger, much more dispersed, and much better defended. The setback strike might buy 3 to 5 years, not a permanent end.
Here's the thing about a 3 to 5 year delay. In 1981, the Osirak strike bought enough time that Iraq never rebuilt its program before the Gulf War ended Saddam's nuclear ambitions entirely. In 2007, the Al-Kibar strike ended Syria's program permanently. But Iran isn't Iraq or Syria. Iran has the industrial base, the scientific expertise, and the institutional knowledge to rebuild. A setback strike isn't a solution. It's a pause.
Every pause comes with a retaliation bill. The question is whether the bill is worth paying for the time it buys.
The retaliation question. Iran retaliated to Operation Rising Lion with over 100 drones. A unilateral Israeli strike without American backing would invite a much larger response, potentially including Hezbollah's full rocket arsenal, which is far more capable than what they've used so far in this conflict.
That's the calculus that makes this so hard. Israel can strike. Israel can set back the program. But can Israel absorb the retaliation without the EU providing defensive support, intelligence, and diplomatic cover? That's the question that keeps Israeli security officials up at night.
Yet, if the alternative is an Iranian nuclear weapon, and the MOU provides no credible path to preventing that, the retaliation calculus becomes secondary. Israel's security establishment has been remarkably consistent over decades. A nuclear Iran is an existential threat, and existential threats require existential responses.
That's why I keep coming back to the 60-day window. If Israel concludes that the MOU is a cover for Iranian breakout, the window for action isn't 60 days. It's however long it takes to plan and execute before the breakout is complete. And that clock might already be ticking.
Here's a question I haven't seen addressed much. What does the EU do if Israel actually goes? Does Trump order EU forces to stand down? Does he provide defensive support for Israel against Iranian retaliation while condemning the strike itself? Does he impose consequences on Israel after the fact?
The most likely EU response, based on everything we've seen, is a messy middle. Private acknowledgement that Israel did what it felt it had to do. Defensive support against Iranian retaliation. Because allowing Americans to die from Iranian missiles to punish Israel is politically impossible, and a furious effort to de-escalate before the whole region catches fire.
Though we condemn this, but we're also shooting down the incoming missiles. Posture.
Which is incoherent as policy, but completely predictable as politics.
It's incoherent, but it's also not unprecedented. Has a long history of publicly opposing Israeli military actions, while privately ensuring Israel doesn't face existential consequences. The baton goes back to the Nixon administration during the 1973 war. Public pressure for a ceasefire, private resupply of Israeli forces. The public-private split is practically an institutional tradition at this point.
That tradition is one of the reasons Israeli planners might feel they can absorb the diplomatic fallout. If the historical pattern holds, Washington will be angry for a few months. There will be stern statements, maybe a delay in some weapons deliveries. And then the relationship will reset, because the underlying strategic interests haven't changed. The question is whether this time is different because the structural break is real.
There's one more dimension to this that's worth flagging. The MOU reportedly includes the release of $25 billion of Iran's frozen assets, though Trump has denied providing cash, saying sanctions could potentially be lifted. If that money flows, Israel's argument becomes even sharper. We just fought a war to degrade Iran's capabilities, and now the deal is recapitalizing them.
That's the sanctions relief piece. And Senator Lindsey Graham has already said any final nuclear deal must be reviewed by Congress. But the MOU itself doesn't require congressional approval. It's an executive agreement, not a treaty. So the $25 billion, if it flows, flows without a vote.
Which gives Netanyahu another domestic argument. The EU is funding the regime we just fought.
It's not just Netanyahu making that argument. Opposition leader Yair Lapid, who wants Netanyahu's job, said, "Netanyahu promised us a historic victory, and we got a crisis with the Americans." But Lapid isn't exactly defending the deal either. The Israeli consensus against this MOU crosses party lines.
That Lapid quote is worth unpacking, because it captures the bind the Israeli opposition is in. They want to attack Netanyahu for the outcome, but they can't defend the deal without looking soft on Iran. So they end up criticizing the process and the messenger without offering a clear alternative. It's a politically safe position, but a strategically empty one.
That vacuum creates space for the hardliners. If the opposition won't articulate an alternative to unilateral action, and the government is signaling that all other options have been exhausted, unilateral action becomes the default. Not because anyone is enthusiastic about it, but because no one is offering a credible off-ramp.
If we're reading the tea leaves for unilateral Israeli action, the political tea leaves are almost as important as the military ones. A prime minister facing elections in October, with 61% of the public saying he shouldn't run, looking at a deal that even his opponents think is a disaster. The political incentive to act is enormous.
The danger, of course, is that political incentives and security imperatives don't always align. Acting to shore up domestic support is not the same thing as acting because the intelligence demands it.
That's where the quality of Israeli intelligence becomes the decisive variable. If the intelligence is solid, if Iran really is using the 60-day window to sprint toward a bomb, then unilateral action is justified, regardless of political timing. If the intelligence is ambiguous, and Netanyahu acts anyway, that's a different story.
We won't know which it is until after the fact, if ever. That's the nature of intelligence on proliferation. It's almost always a matter of judgment, not certainty. The famous, "we assess with moderate confidence" formulation.
That phrase, "moderate confidence," has launched 1,000 think tank panels. It's the intelligence community's way of saying, we think this is probably true, but if we're wrong, don't blame us. And when the stakes are existential, probably true, is a terrifyingly thin reed to hang a decision on.
That's the reality of proliferation intelligence. You're almost never going to get a smoking gun. You're going to get satellite photos of construction that could be a nuclear facility or could be a warehouse. You're going to get signals intelligence that could be a weapons program or could be routine military communications. You're going to get human sources who might be accurate or might be feeding you what you want to hear. And you have to make a decision anyway.
Let's go back to Daniel's core question one more time. What are the signs? If you had to give someone a single thing to watch for in the next 2 weeks, what would it be?
If I had to pick one, watch for a sudden, unexplained gap between what Israel is saying publicly and what it's saying to Washington privately. When that gap widens to the point where the EU seems surprised by Israeli actions, that's the moment. We saw a version of it with Operation Rising Lion. Trump knew in advance, but the EU wasn't involved. If the next operation happens without even that level of heads up, that's the signal that Israel has decided to go it alone.
For the listener who isn't plugged into diplomatic back channels, the public version of that signal is, watch for Israel to stop talking about the MOU entirely, not criticizing it, not demanding changes, just acting as if it doesn't exist. When the deal becomes irrelevant in Israeli official discourse, that's when you know they've moved on.
Silence is a signal too.
There's a historical parallel here that's worth noting. In the weeks before the 1981 Oserek strike, Israeli officials stopped engaging with diplomatic efforts entirely. They didn't argue, they didn't lobby, they didn't warn. They just went quiet. When the strike happened, the Reagan administration was genuinely surprised, not because they didn't know Israel was concerned about the Iraqi program, but because Israel had stopped signaling that action was imminent.
The quiet period is operationally necessary, but it also serves a political function. It denies the other side the opportunity to mobilize diplomatic opposition. If you're not telegraphing, no one can talk you out of it.
No, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
I have no idea where he's going with this one.
In the 1940s, a marine biologist in Belize discovered that the pigmentation of hammerhead sharks' electroreceptive ampullae contains a unique melanin variant that darkens in response to electrical fields, essentially making their heads natural voltage-sensitive film.
Sharks with mood ring heads.
I have so many questions, and I know none of them will be answered. Do the sharks know? Like, are they aware their heads are changing color? Is there a social dimension to this?
You're trying to apply logic to a Hilbert fact, and that way lies madness.
I'll save it for the next time I'm at an aquarium and want to ruin everyone's day with unanswerable questions.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you've got a question you want us to dig into, send it our way. We read everyone.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.